It's very lovely to be here this morning. A little strange, but slightly very lovely. So, earlier this week, I experienced an amazing coincidence. I had been meaning to email somebody for some days, but for a variety of what I assure you were perfectly good reasons, I hadn't got around to it. You may have been in this position yourself. I was hurrying one afternoon towards work in Wareham, not exactly running late, but not with any time to spare. And who should I see walking towards me but the very person I had been meaning to email, someone who doesn't live in Wareham and, as far as I know, had no particular reason to be there. We stopped. We had a chat. It was a useful and important chat. Coincidence or something else? Esther. The Book of Esther, as Lindy has already told us, is a very good story. I really like a very good story. But what actually makes a good story? This summer, when I was on holiday and had lots of time for reading things that were not to do with studying, I came across a series of fantasy adventure books that I hadn't read before. That's one of my preferred reading genres. It was rather like a cross between Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. Anybody else into that sort of reading? Talk to me. No? A few yeses, quite a few noes. Okay, well, that's what I like. They have, like so many good stories, the hero, possibly not a superhero, but definitely a hero, the requisite baddie and his followers, and a situation that needs resolving. It's a pattern that's in lots of good stories, whether they're films, books, TV, radio, whatever. The story of the fight of good against evil. But a good story, in my opinion, also has something else. It has coincidences. Those moments when you're watching and something happens and you go, oh no! Or possibly, oh yes! The Book of Esther has the strange distinction of being the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention God. Yet despite the fact that he's never actually directly named or referred to, it is possible to see his hand at work in all sorts of ways. Unless, of course, those things are just coincidences. Back to Esther. Esther becomes queen through a remarkable set of happenings. King Xerxes already has a queen, Vashti. But then the king has a party, a very long party. Esther chapter 1, verses 10 to 12 says this. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and the nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. So, Xerxes has been partying for 7 days with his friends. He sends for his queen to put on her crown and come and display her beauty to him and his drunken friends. Yeah, you're with me, aren't you? Vashti, very sensibly, in my opinion, but totally against the customs of that time, says, no way, mate. This makes the king really angry, but also very concerned. What if word of what Vashti has done gets out? What if other women begin to think that it's okay not to do what their husbands say? The king asks advice. His advisors suggest that he should send Vashti away so that her bad example does not spread. This he does, and then sends out his servants across the whole of his kingdom to look for some beautiful virgins to come and become part of his harem so that he can choose a new and beautiful wife. It just so happens that one of the girls chosen is a young Jewish girl called Esther. someone who had probably never had any idea of or any desire to become part of the community at the palace. But she's chosen. As Lindy said, she's taken to the palace. Mordecai, the cousin who has brought her up, follows. He plants himself at the palace gates so that he can continue to keep an eye on her from a distance. Even in the palace, Esther continues to follow Mordecai's instructions. And because he has said so, she keeps her Jewish identity a secret, even when at a later time she's actually chosen to be the queen. Coincidence, do you think? Or God quietly at work? So Mordecai sits at the palace gate, keeping an eye on his young cousin. And as he sits there one day, he just happens to overhear a conversation. Chapter 2, verses 21 to 23 says this. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. When the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. So, this event happens, is recorded in the official records, and completely forgotten about. Hold that thought, it will come back. Of course, Mordecai could have decided to say nothing when he overheard the conversation. Assassination plots are dodgy to get involved with in any way, even if you think you're doing the right thing. And King Xerxes did not have a great reputation for being fair and kind. Esther could have decided to say nothing for much the same reason. Mordecai just happening to overhear about the plot presented both him and Esther with a decision to make, one which was going to have later repercussions. Coincidence? Or God quietly at work? Then the requisite baddie arrives on the scene. Haman. You can shout boo if you like. That's good. Haman is the most important of the king's nobles, and everybody is supposed to bow as he passes them by. But there is one person who won't. Or at least, there's one person who gets noticed because he won't. Guess who? Brilliant, Mordecai. Out of all the Jews in the whole kingdom, why does it have to be Mordecai? Why is he the one that gets noticed? He can't have been the only Jew who refused to bow to Haman, can he? Anyway, he's the one who gets caught. Haman seriously takes the hump. Obviously, from his point of view, he will have to kill Mordecai. But he decides that it's not enough to just get rid of Mordecai. Haman wants to get rid of all of Mordecai's people across the whole kingdom. He asks King Xerxes if this is okay, and Xerxes says, yeah, fine. Of course, Xerxes is not aware that he's signing the death warrant of his queen, because Esther has kept that quiet on Mordecai's instructions. You know the way that sometimes when you read a children's book as an adult, you find layers of meaning that you didn't see when you were younger? Have you ever done that? Yeah? And you know the way that sometimes you think you know a Bible story because you've known it since you were in Sunday school, and then suddenly you discover there are actually all sorts of bits in it that you hadn't noticed before? Yeah? Have you ever been there? For me, this was one of those bits. I think this discovery is something that comes with ordination training, possibly. But chapter 3, verse 13 says, dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. Just in case, like me, you didn't already know this, apparently this is the day before the Passover. Passover being the day that Jewish people celebrate God rescuing them from being slaves in Egypt. So this date that Haman has chosen comes with all the connotations of a celebration of the rescue of the Jewish people and the question of whether they can be rescued again. Coincidence? When Mordecai hears what Haman is planning, he weeps and wails with the rest of the Jewish people. And then he suggests to Esther that it might be down to her to do something about this. Esther sends a message to Mordecai. The words written in scripture are rather more eloquent, but the feeling behind the words is, "What, me? I can't do that." Perhaps the lovely Esther is something of a reluctant superhero at this point. Mordecai points out very bluntly that just because Esther happens to live within the palace walls doesn't necessarily mean that she will not suffer the same fate as the rest of her people. And then we get what's possibly the best known verse from the book of Esther, as Mordecai says, "If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this?" Perhaps all those remarkable coincidences were actually part of the plan. The messages continue to ping backwards and forwards between Esther and Mordecai, almost like email does between many of us these days. And in the end, Esther says, "Okay, let's all fast for 3 days and then I'll do it. I'll go see the king, and if I perish, I perish." Now, if Esther was a TV series, that would be the moment when you get the closing credits and the theme tune and everyone goes, "Oh no!" But we're not going to have to wait till next week to find out what happens next. Esther goes to see the king, and it's okay. He extends to her the golden scepter, which means she can come into his presence without being killed. She invites the king and Haman to come to a banquet the following day, and they accept. Haman goes off feeling very proud and congratulating himself on how important he has become. But on his way home, he is reminded that Mordecai is still something of a thorn in his flesh. So, on the advice of his family and his friends, that very evening, Haman erects a large pole on which he plans to impale Mordecai the following day. They were a bit gruesome, weren't they? But he has to check it out with the king first. It just so happens that the king has difficulty in getting to sleep that night. It just so happens that he decides the way to get to sleep is to have someone read to him. He requests that they bring the book of the record of his reign, and it just so happens that the bit they read is about when Mordecai told him about the assassination plot. This pricks the conscience of King Xerxes as he realizes that Mordecai saved his life and he's completely forgotten to say thank you. He asks the advice of his most trusted noble, Haman. Chapter 6, verses 6 to 9 has this account of the encounter. "When Haman entered, the king asked him, 'What should be done for the man who the king delights to honor?' Now Haman, being a bit of a big head," sorry, that bit's not in the Bible. "Haman thought to himself, 'Who is there that the king would rather honor than me?' So he answered the king, 'For the man the king delights to honor, let them bring a royal robe that the king has worn, and a horse that the king has ridden, one with the royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor."'" I would love to have seen the look on Haman's face when the king says, good idea. Go and do that for Mordecai. In terms of the story, though, this is the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of the fall of Haman, the beginning of the rise of Mordecai, and the beginning of the rescue of the Jewish people by superhero Esther. Esther's banquet happens. Haman's evil plan is revealed, and he is condemned to death. Execution on the very same pole he had put up for Mordecai. The edict that has gone out ordering the slaughter of all the Jewish people is rescinded, and in a rather gruesome final battle, the Jewish people are given permission to slaughter all those who would have slaughtered them. There are some rather difficult bits in Esther, but that might be something for another day. Time issue, you understand, not me just copping out. So Mordecai takes the place that Haman once occupied as the king's number two. The Jewish festival of Purim is established so that no one should forget what Esther did. And so the story of Esther, a series of coincidences, or the hand of an unseen and unmentioned God at work? And superhero Esther, a girl following the instructions of the one person who, as Lindy said earlier, she knew had always remained true to her, following the instructions of Mordecai? Or was she a girl following the call of God on her life, afraid at first, but later accepting the risk involved? And what about us? We all have a call on our lives too. A different call for each one of us. For some of us, it will be a call that will take us into risky places like Esther, and I know there are people here who have already answered that kind of call. For some, like for me last week, it will be a call that requires us to do seemingly small things, like being prepared to stop and engage in conversation with the person that you meet in town. And of course, there'll be all manner of things in between those two extremes. For all of us, though, in whatever way it shows up, there is a call to look out for and respond to where God is at work, even when, in the story of Esther, he's not named or immediately obvious to us. We're going to finish off this part of the service by sitting quietly for a few minutes with some gentle music that I hope Mike's going to come back and provide for us. And we're just going to think about where we might have seen God at work in ways that are not so obvious recently. Have you had an experience like I did of just happening to cross paths with someone? Maybe at the time you didn't see that God's hand was in it. Perhaps it did just look like a coincidence. But maybe it wasn't just a coincidence. Perhaps it was God calling you to do something, however big or small it might have been. So let's just sit quietly for a few minutes and think about where we've seen him at work, asking him to help us see more clearly where he is at work and showing us where he's calling us to join in with him.